What's going on? Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It is heard live every day from noon to 3 on WBT Radio in Charlotte. And if you want exclusive content, like invitations to events, the weekly live stream, my daily show prep with all the links, become a patron. Go to thepetecallinershow.com. Make sure you hit the subscribe button. Get every episode for free right to your smartphone or tablet. And again, thank you so much for your support.
Hang on a second. I'm getting an email here. Oh, from the White House. Says, it's a really nice FCC license you have there. It would be a shame if something happened to it. Don't talk about the Supreme Court ruling today. Well, I, for one, am not going to talk about that Supreme Court ruling then. It's my own decision, you see. I made it after, yeah, I mean, I may have been, you know, chatting a little bit with federal officials, you know, back channels and such, that had I not read that email on the air, you never would have even known about, right? So, right, so that's kind of at the heart of this this ruling that came down today. Now, the Supreme Court punted, as they are known to do on controversial cases. They don't want to wade into something. They will find any escape hatch to jump through so they don't have to actually rule on a case that would set some sort of precedent, some, you know, create some upheaval or something. And I also have been seeing people kind of bewildered at why they only released two rulings today. I guess they've got one more. No, they wouldn't even have one more round. They should have. Yeah, because we're still waiting on the Chevron case, and I've got that one in the stack here just coincidentally, but maybe they'll do that tomorrow. I don't know, but you've got the presidential debate tomorrow night. They know that. Anything that they don't, and by the way, one thing to always keep in mind, this is not just for Supreme Court rulings, but it's actually pretty much the rule of thumb, which is when there is a debate, mainstream or legacy media outlets will drop stories the morning of the debate or the night before, right? So it is in the next day's news cycle. They will drop their stories in order to get more coverage because the story then gets picked up by the moderators and they ask the candidates about the story. Happens all the time. Happens almost every, I cannot remember the last time that it hasn't happened. It's like clockwork. So I'm curious as to what story is going to drop. I'm sure it's going to be some sort of anti-Trump story. Actually, hang on a second. You know what? Let me just take a look. There's a website I've talked about. It's called Memorandum, and it's an aggregator. Okay, so the top story here on their list of stories that are, you know, moving is Trump trusted more than Biden on democracy among key swing state voters. Ooh, wow, that's got to hurt. Most Americans plan to watch. Oh, Adam Kinzinger endorses Biden. Wow, who would have guessed? Obama has anxiety over the election. He's holding secret meetings with Biden. How many advisors does Biden need on this debate prep team anyway? What's he up to? It's like 38, 39, something like that. It's ridiculous. I like how they're also doing it in an airplane hangar. Have you heard this? That they've been staging it in a hangar, which is important because anybody with, you know, any relatives who are battling cognitive decline, you know, you want to get them familiar with their surroundings. When you bring them into unfamiliar surroundings, they get confused pretty easily, right? So it makes sense. Recreate the setting so he feels comfortable when he arrives at the setting and then he's able to sit down. I wonder, are they going to walk them out and then have them sit down? I got a lot of questions. We'll see tomorrow night. All right. So I don't see any story that has dropped here about Trump. His claims that Biden is jacked up on drugs is more than projection. It's cult condition. It's not actually. So, and I'm going to get to this too. Yeah, I'm going to get to the whether or not Joe Biden's on drugs or not, performance-enhancing drugs. We'll get to that. But I want to start off with the Supreme Court ruling. I have the parts of the ruling. It's like 68 pages. I was not able to read through the entire thing, but I have read through the syllabus of it, and I read a lot of the arguments that were made in support of the syllabus, which is the majority opinion. The syllabus is like sort of a condensation. That's water related. It's a condensed version of the majority opinion. And then there's the dissenting opinion. I read through most of that. Okay, so here's the syllabus, sort of a, well, I'll tell you what it, they have a sort of a description here. It says, where it is feasible, a syllabus will be released, as is being done in connection with this case at the time the opinion is issued. The syllabus constitutes no part of the opinion of the court, but has been prepared by the reporter of decisions for the convenience of the reader. Well, thank you, reporter of decisions. How would you like that title? I am the reporter of decisions. You make the decision, I report the decision. Do you think that person in their marriage, do you think that like their spouse is like, sorry, you don't get to make this decision. You're just the reporter of the decisions. Right. Okay. Anyway, I mean, that's what I would do. All right. This is what the syllabus reads. Under their longstanding content moderation policies, social media platforms have taken a range of actions to suppress certain categories of speech, including speech they judge to be false or misleading. In 2020, with the outbreak of COVID-19, the platforms announced that they would enforce these policies against users who post false or misleading content about the pandemic. The platforms also applied misinformation policies during the 2020 election season. During that period, various federal officials regularly spoke with the platforms about COVID-19 and election-related, quote, misinformation. All right, I'm putting quotes on that. The syllabus does not. I'm slapping quotes on that because misinformation was in the eye of the beholder, and all those eyes were lefties. Goes on to say that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, along with CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, the CISA, communicated with the platforms about election-related misinformation in advance of the 2020 presidential election and the 2022 midterms. Now, if you listen to talk radio, well, conservative talk radio, I should say. I need to clarify that because if you're listening to the NPR affiliate, all they're talking about is how Donald Trump is a tyrant and how he's going to destroy America and democracy. Like I bounce over there and I listen on the way into the studio here, usually every day, just get a sense of what they're talking about. Today they're talking about grilling. But like every single day, it's the same thing over and over and over and over again. They just bring in different lefties, different reporters, that I repeat myself, and they just, you know, constantly doom predict. I mean, it's just that's all they do. Donald Trump is a threat. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I cannot imagine if I were only to consume that media. Like if I'm just a public radio listener, and so I'm so well informed, and all you hear is you need to be terrified if Donald Trump wins. No wonder these people are crazy. Well, maybe they're crazy first. That's why they listen to, well, I don't know, chicken and egg, whatever. But holy cow. Way to feed the anxiety and neurosis, right? Neuroticism. There's an N on that word. Neuroticism. Okay. Two states and five individual social media users who sued dozens of executive branch officials and agencies alleging that the government pressured the platforms to censor their speech in violation of the First Amendment. And what the Supreme Court said was they don't have standing. That was how they punted. The Supreme Court punted this decision. They didn't want to have to go and do all of the work, and they didn't want to make a ruling on this, and so they just punted it in a 6-3 majority opinion. The dissent was written by Sam Alito, who, full disclosure, I tend to agree with Alito's views. I find myself in agreement with his views more than any other justice. Clarence Thomas too. But Alito, usually if Alito is writing it, I'm in line with that. So the six-member majority was Amy Coney Barrett. In agreement with her was Chief Justice Roberts, Sotomayor, Kagan, Kavanaugh, and Jackson. Okay, so your three Republican appointees, Roberts, Barrett, and Kavanaugh. So two Trump appointees and Roberts, joined with the three liberals. Dissent, Thomas, Gorsuch, and Alito. Okay, if you're listening to this podcast, you are obviously paying attention to the world around us. You also have really great taste, I might add. But if you haven't started getting prepared for various emergencies, I got to ask, what are you waiting for? Please call my friends Bill and Jan at Carolina Readiness Supply, and they'll help get you started. If you have no idea how to start, they can help you. If you're an experienced prepper, they can help you too. Being prepared is just smart. We've already established that you're smart. I mean, you listen to this podcast after all. So let's put those smarts into action. Go to CarolinaReadiness.com. That's CarolinaReadiness.com or call them at 828-226-7239. Carolina Readiness Supply has 2,000 square feet of supplies as well as educational materials that you're going to need for any kind of emergency. Veteran-owned Carolina Readiness Supply. Will you be ready when the lights go out? Alrighty, so the U.S. Supreme Court holds that neither the individual nor the state plaintiffs have established Article III standing to seek an injunction against any defendant. And so that's why I say they punted the case. They did not rule on the merits. They just said, you don't have standing to be in front of the U.S. Supreme Court to get this injunction. Okay. The plaintiff's theories of standing depend on the platform's actions, right? Facebook, Twitter, right? Yet the plaintiffs do not seek to enjoin the platforms from restricting any posts or accounts. Instead, they seek to enjoin the government agencies and officials from pressuring or encouraging the platforms to suppress protected speech in the future. So that's one of the reasons why there's the 6-3 majority says they shouldn't look at the case. Because it's the platform's actions, yet you're going after the government agencies. They say the one step removed anticipatory nature of the plaintiff's alleged injuries presents two challenges. First, it's a bedrock principle that a federal court cannot redress injury that results from the independent action of some third party that's not before the court. Right? So maybe they should have lumped in Facebook and Twitter and the other social media platforms, right? So that's the first thing. Bedrock principle that a federal court cannot redress injury that results from an independent action of a third party that's not in front of the court as part of this case. Number two, the second part of the challenge is that because the plaintiffs request forward-looking relief, so something in the future, they must face a real and immediate threat of repeated injury. Right, so you can't say, well, this thing happened to me and I'm afraid it might happen again, but there's no evidence that it could happen again or is likely to happen again or repeatedly will happen again in the future. So they say putting these requirements together, the plaintiffs must show a substantial risk that in the near future, at least one platform will restrict the speech of at least one plaintiff in response to the actions of at least one government defendant. So they have to prove something is going to happen in the future. So that's quite the low bar to get over, if I do say so myself. I mean, like, this is missing the forest for the trees here, you know? This is the thing about lawyers. Don't get me wrong. I love lawyers. They serve a purpose. But the twisting of the language, right, and the reaching for the obtuse in order to cover what is obvious. Like, guys, you really don't think this is going to happen again? Of course it's going to happen again. Why wouldn't it happen again? And now you've got government agents and officials that will look at this and say, okay, well, as long as we, you know, just intimate things like, it'd be a shame if that thing happened to you, something happened to you there. Oh, wow, it'd be awful if that Section 230 got a rewrite. Social media platforms now are going to be able to work hand in glove with government under this precedent. Unless somebody comes back through and sues again and gets all the way up to the Supreme Court. They say, while the record reflects that the government defendants played a role in at least some of the platform's moderation choices, the evidence indicates that the platforms had independent incentives to moderate content and often exercised their own judgment. The Fifth Circuit, by attributing every platform decision, at least in part, to the defendants, glossed over complexities in the evidence. The Fifth Circuit also erred by treating the defendants, plaintiffs, and platforms each as a unified whole. Okay, so I guess we need to break up the plaintiffs, right? Have individuals start suing alone, I guess. U.S. Supreme Court totally punts on the government, pressure campaign. Jawboning, basically, is what this is. Jawboning, where government officials bully private entities or citizens, right, by yapping, by talking. And so the Supreme Court says, you guys who sued, you don't have standing. They say the plaintiffs fail by and large to link their past social media restrictions and the defendants' communications with the platforms. They say there's the lack of evidence presented by the plaintiffs makes it impossible to prove direct causation. Like, I want you to do something, and then Facebook does that thing. It appears that the frequent, intense communications that took place in 2021 between the government, defendants, and the platforms had considerably subsided by 2022, when one of the plaintiffs filed suit. Thus, it is no more than conjecture to assume that she will be subject to government-induced content moderation. So because it started to wane, which, by the way, I would submit that the reason why it started to wane was because of the exposure of the pressure campaign, the jawboning, by journalists such as those Michael Schellenberger, Matt Taibbi, who did work on the Twitter files, right? Oh, wait. Right. Yeah. Okay. There have been subsequent batches of emails that have been reported on from Facebook as well. And then you've got the House committees that began investigations in 2022. And that's where a lot more of this information has come out. Now, the dissent written by Alito. I have it here. He says, victims of the campaign, perceived by the lower courts, brought this action to ensure that the government did not continue to coerce social media platforms to suppress speech. Among these victims were two states whose public health officials were hampered in their ability to share their expertise with their state residents, distinguished professors of medicine at Stanford and Harvard, a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine, and the owner and operator of a news website, and Jill Hines, the director of a consumer and human rights advocacy organization. By the way, that news website was Gateway Pundit, so I'm not really sure that counts as news, but okay. All these victims simply wanted to speak out on a question of the utmost public importance. To protect their right to do so, the district court issued a preliminary injunction, and the Court of Appeals found ample evidence to support injunctive relief, right? To bar the federal government from getting in the way of what they're trying to do by pressuring the social media companies. Now, if the lower court's assessment of the voluminous record is correct, this is one of the most important free speech cases to reach this court in years, he says. Freedom of speech serves many valuable purposes, but its most important role is protection of speech that is essential to democratic self-government and speech that advances humanity's store of knowledge, thought, and expression in fields such as science, medicine, history, the social sciences, philosophy, and the arts. The speech at issue falls squarely into those categories. Right? In other words, if ever there's a case that needs to be heard, this is it. He says government officials may not coerce private entities to suppress speech. The record before us is vast. It contains evidence of communications between many different government actors and a variety of internet platforms, as well as evidence regarding the effects of those interactions on the seven different plaintiffs. He says the record plainly shows for months in 2021 and 2022, a group of officials at the highest levels of the federal government continuously harried and implicitly threatened Facebook with potentially crippling consequences if it did not comply with their wishes about the suppression of certain COVID-19 related speech. Not surprisingly, Facebook repeatedly yielded. As a result, Jill Hynes was indisputably, because he focused his dissent on just her case, because he said it was representative of the larger issue at play. So he focused on Hynes in his dissent. As a result, Hynes was indisputably injured, and due to the official's continuing efforts, she was threatened with more of the same when she brought suit. This evidence was more than sufficient to establish Hynes's standing to sue. And consequently, we are obligated to tackle the free speech issue that the case presents. The court, however, shirks that duty and thus permits the successful campaign of coercion in this case to stand as an attractive model for future officials who want to control what the people say, hear, and think. That is regrettable. Sam Alito's dissent in the free speech case that the Supreme Court punted today and basically gave the green light for bureaucrats, government officials, to jawbone and pressure social media companies to restrict content that the government doesn't want. But it's totally not against free speech. Okay. Just build your own Facebook, man. Okay. Alito says because of the perpetrator's high positions in the government, it was even more dangerous. It was blatantly unconstitutional, and the country may come to regret the court's failure to say so. Officials who read today's decision will get the message. If a coercive campaign is carried out with enough sophistication, it may get by. That is not a message that this court should send. He said two prominent facts should be kept in mind. Number one, social media have become a leading source of news for many Americans. And with the decline of other media, their importance may grow. Second, internet platforms, although rich and powerful, are at the same time far more vulnerable to government pressure than other news sources. If a president dislikes a particular newspaper, he, fortunately, lacks the ability to put that paper out of business. But for Facebook and many other social media platforms, the situation is fundamentally different. They are critically dependent on the protection provided by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996. 230 shields them from civil liability for content that they spread. They are vulnerable to antitrust actions. Indeed, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has described a potential antitrust lawsuit as a, quote, existential threat to his company. And because their substantial overseas operations may be subjected to tough regulation in the European Union and other foreign jurisdictions, they rely on the federal government's diplomatic efforts to protect their interests. I have said this for over 25 years. I call this the unholy alliance, business and government. Business using government, government using business. Right? If Facebook did not have to rely on the federal government's diplomatic efforts to protect their interests, they would tell the White House to go pound sand. They could. I don't know if they would, but anyway, so those are the two things that Alito is urging his colleagues to keep in mind in his dissent. He says, for these and other reasons, internet platforms have a powerful incentive to please important federal officials. He goes on to say that the government agents skillfully exploited Facebook's vulnerability. When Facebook did not heed their requests as quickly or as fully as the officials wanted, the platform was publicly accused of killing people. COVID. Insurrection. Right? And Facebook was subtly threatened with retaliation. Not surprisingly, these efforts bore fruit. Facebook adopted new rules that better conformed to the officials' wishes, and many users who expressed disapproved views about the pandemic or COVID-19 vaccines were deplatformed or otherwise injured. He goes on to say, I'm almost at the end here, just a little bit, and I'm just giving you some highlighted portions that I found. Actually, I had another one here. I think Dan Bishop had one that he had highlighted on Twitter. Let's see if I can find it. I cannot. I thought I had bookmarked it. It's one of the, sometimes the likes and I know my likes are private. Stop telling me that. Here it is. Here is the part that Dan Bishop highlighted. Congressman Dan Bishop, running for Attorney General. He said, what the officials did in this case, this is the quote that Dan Bishop pulled from Alito's dissent. What the officials did in this case was more subtle than the ham-handed censorship found to be unconstitutional in the Vulo ruling. But it was no less coercive. And because of their high positions, it was even more dangerous. It was blatantly unconstitutional. So Bishop pulled the same part I did. He then goes on to say, the doctrine of standing is necessary to keep the judiciary within its bounds. Here, it constrains the Supreme Court to leave unaddressed arguably the most massive attack on free speech in U.S. history. That means it falls on Congress and the president to stop this unconstitutional abuse, and thus far both have utterly failed. Internal Facebook emails, Alito writes, paint a clear picture of subservience to the feds. The platform quickly realized that its, quote, handling of misinformation was important to the White House, so it looked for ways to, quote, be viewed as a trusted, transparent partner and, quote, avoid public spats. After the White House blamed Facebook for aiding the insurrection of J6, the platform realized that it was, quote, at a crossroads with the White House, end quote. That comes from internal emails. Given what's at stake here, one Facebook employee proposed reevaluating the company's internal methods to see what further steps we may or may not be able to take. This reevaluation led to one of Facebook's policy changes. So I would submit there was causal or causation evidence or evidence of causation, but the majority did not want to look at it. All right, so let's go over to the phone lines. Here's Robert. Welcome to the show. Hey, Robert.
Hey, I just want to remind you that didn't Mark Zuckerberg give like $480 million to the Democratic Party in 2020 towards the towards November? That's a lot of money for an individual or his company to be giving to. Talk about an unholy alliance, right?
Well, yeah. I don't know where the 480 figure comes from that you're talking about. I know it was large. He spent money on all sorts of, what did they call them? Voter registration was one element of it. But they sent down grants to boards of elections, to state boards of elections, local boards of elections, to get to help with the COVID response and all of that. And for some reason, we will probably never know why, but most of the money ended up in heavy Democrat strongholds.
Yeah,
I'm sure. Yeah, just coincidence.
All right, have a good day.
All right, man. Appreciate the call, Robert. I'm not sure how much money he donated to individual Democrats. I'm sure it was not insignificant, though. I don't remember all of the totals. I've got somewhere in one of my stacks of prep, I've got the Zuckerberg, the Zuck Bucks. figures, but I don't think I have it with me right now. But it was a lot of money. It may not be the precise number that Robert named, but it's in that ballpark. Right? It was a lot of money. Hundreds of millions of dollars. Alito concludes, in sum, the officials wielded potent authority. Their communications with Facebook were virtual demands, and Facebook's quavering responses to those demands show that it felt a strong need to yield. All right, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I could not do the show without your support and the support of the businesses that advertise on the podcast. So if you'd like, please support them too and tell them you heard it here. You can also become a patron at my Patreon page or go to thepetecallinershow.com. Again, thank you so much for listening, and don't break anything while I'm gone.